Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Daryl Castle with today's podcast. Today is Wednesday, May 6, 2015, and on today's podcast, we turn our attention back to the religion of Islam once more, and we are going to look at the ancient divide that has plagued Islam from its beginning, along with separate schisms within those divides. Does hope of reconciliation exist, and if so, is that hope justified? Muslims split into two main sects or divisions shortly after the death of their prophet Muhammad in the year 632. As he predicted, it would split. The two sects are Sunni, which is by far the largest, with about 85 to 90% of all Muslims on earth. The rest are Shia, or some minor offshoot of Islam. The two sects coexist to some extent, but to a far larger degree, they hate each other. They war against each other. But Washington comes along and gives them something that they hate worse than each other. The two sides do not interact much outside the public sphere, although there are exceptions in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, for example, at least in the urban areas. Sunnis and Shias sometimes even intermarried, but Washington came along and spoiled that party. Most differences lie in the fields of doctrine, religious ritual, Islamic law, theology, organization of their religion, and so forth. The Sunnis regard themselves as the orthodox traditionalist branch of Islam. In other words, their view of Islam is the correct one. The word Sunni comes from al-Sunnah, which means the people of the tradition. More so than the Shia, Sunni clerics historically have been controlled by the various state governments in which they live and work, rather than the other way around. The name Shia comes from Shi'at Ali, or the party of Ali. They claim the right of Ali, the son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad and his descendants, to lead Islam. The Shia have a strong concept of martyrdom and a messianic element to their faith. If one-tenth of all Muslims in the world are Shia, that would be somewhere between 120 and 170 million people. Shias are the majority in Iran, Iraq, Bahrain, Azerbaijan, and probably Yemen as well. Large numbers of Shia live in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Kuwait, Lebanon, Qatar, Syria, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. In Sunni-governed countries, Shia usually make up the poorest elements of society. They view themselves as victims of discrimination and oppression. The Iranian Revolution in 1979 launched a Shia revolution and an agenda that was a direct challenge to the more traditionalist Sunni regimes across the Middle East, particularly Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Arab states. Iran has a policy of supporting Shia forces beyond its borders, such as Hezbollah in Lebanon on Israel's northern border. In other war-torn areas, such as Pakistan and Afghanistan, Sunni groups, such as the Taliban, often attack Shia mosques. The conflict in Syria and Iraq involve forces on both sides, which Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State can easily take advantage of. There are even divisions within divisions of Islam. Sunni governments are not unified. They have not been unified over the years, but the conflict in Yemen between forces led by Sunni-governed Saudi Arabia and those of Shia Iran have the potential of unifying the Sunni governments across the Middle East into a solid coalition. The Houthi movement in Yemen, supported by Iran, triggered a nervous response from Sunni states. A 10-nation coalition was mobilized. The Saudi-led effort to mobilize and unify Sunni nations has served, although to expose their divisions. So the countries not in the coalition are as important as those that are in. Turkey, for example. Turkey criticized Iran but has refused to commit any forces to the war. Turkey is one of four actual real nations that want a regional leadership role in the Middle East. That would be Turkey, Egypt, Iran, and Israel. So it makes no sense for the Turks to join a Saudi force. That would only make the Saudis stronger. There seemed to be a big difference between Turkish and Saudi visions of what the Middle East region should look like. The Turks would like to see impediments to their efforts at regional dominance removed, impediments such as Iran and Mr. Assad in Syria. But they will not build Saudi power in order to remove those impediments. The Sunni coalition, then, is really an Arab coalition, since it is missing Turkey, and it is missing Pakistan. Pakistan, a Sunni country far away, with no regional ambitions. The coalition, then, is made up so far of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain, Jordan, Egypt, Sudan, and Morocco, an Arab coalition, as I said. These states are also divided, with some being conservative monarchies and some being radical Islamists. Saudi Arabia is by far the largest contributor of money and aircraft. The Gulf Arab states and Saudi Arabia have been shaping the region with money from oil under their sands. The Arab states and the other states in this coalition are only going to help with Saudi regional dominance to a certain point, only to a certain point. Thus, the coalition remains divided. It remains weaker than it should. Finally, folks, where does all this leave the West? Where does it leave the United States? Peace is an advantage because it slows the flow of migrants from war-torn Middle Eastern countries to Europe and the United States, and it continues the flow of oil, and I might add, it is less destructive of human life. Sunnis and Shias, perhaps, if the West will allow it, can just return to hating and killing each other rather than hating and killing us. At least that's the way I see it, folks. Until next time, this is Darrell Castle. Thanks for listening.